Good evening, and welcome to University Temple United Methodist Church. I'm Reverend Sharon Moe, senior pastor here at University Temple, and it's a pleasure to welcome all of you here this evening on behalf of the members of this congregation and on behalf of all of those persons who have worked to organize this evening's event. These, as we all know, are difficult times for perhaps especially those of us who believe that there are other options for decision-making about how we live together as members of a global society than those that are currently being chosen and exercised. In regard to Iraq, in regard to Afghanistan, in regard to terrorism, there seems to be so very little we can do to act or to speak out for justice and compassion for life itself. And yet, in these times, it is necessary and urgent for each of us and all of us together to act and speak in some way for a vision of global relationship and dignity, global justice that we all hold so dear. In the confusing chaos of inadequate information and deliberate disinformation that swims about us these days, Mr. von Sponeck is a strong voice of clear truth. I believe that this evening's words by Hans von Sponeck will contribute to our sense of both agency and possibility. And so I am utterly grateful to be able to welcome him and host him here this evening. It is a rare pleasure and an honor to welcome you to this Seattle speaking engagement and to University Temple. Mr. von Sponeck combines the gifts that I have noticed of clarity of perspective and compassion of heart. He has a keen, perhaps innate, sense of justice and fair play, as well as a profound conviction in the worth of every human being. It is a privilege to have him here with us this evening at University Temple. There is an information table outside this sanctuary, so I hope you will be sure to stop after this evening's lecture and question and answer period and pick up information that you do not already have. And also, following Mr. von Sponeck's lecture and question and answer time, you're invited to a reception in the parlor just down the hall where you can continue conversations and perhaps start some new conversations. Now, to introduce Mr. von Sponeck to you further and to welcome him on behalf of the larger community of faith in the Seattle area, let me call upon the Reverend John Boonstra, who is the executive minister of the Washington Association of Churches. Again, welcome.
Good evening, everyone. It's an honor to introduce our speaker this evening. Hans von Sponeck is with us tonight to reflect on the topic, "Who is speaking for Iraq's children? U.S. sanctions and Mideast anger." If ever there was a moment when we needed to hear from a person of conscience in an unconscionable political situation, tonight is the night. We gather this evening in the midst of sobering and precarious times, when bombs fall relentlessly, with merciless calculation, and with callous disregard for innocent peoples in Afghanistan, when our understandings of justice, peace, and security are cleverly twisted to blur our vision of the truth about U.S. political and economic foreign policy, when our international policies are solidified by fear, anger, and economic self-interest, not by an ethical awareness of our connectedness with one another, when racial profiling, secret detentions by executive orders, and raids on immigrant community centers seek to divide, fragment, and immobilize us, when the U.S. flag is used not as a symbol of the democracy-seeking people we aspire to be, but as a weapon that reveals the fearful people we have become. When faith-based and humanitarian advocacy is seen not as constructive dissent in our national debate, but as co-conspiratorial cooperation with terrorism. And when our leaders use manipulative political rhetoric about the evil ones and do not lead us, do not elevate our thinking to see the evil in our own ways. On a night like tonight, we have special need to hear from Hans von Sponeck. Mr. von Sponeck was UN humanitarian coordinator in Baghdad from 1998 to 2000. He joined the UN Development Program in 1968, and for more than three decades, he worked in the countries now at the center of our daily thoughts, including India and Pakistan in the 80s and 90s. Later in 1998, he was appointed UN humanitarian coordinator for Iraq. There, he traveled throughout the country, directing all UN operations, managing the distribution of goods under the Oil for Food program, and verifying Iraqi compliance with that program. But that was the beginning for an altogether different journey. After a 34-year career, Mr. von Sponeck resigned in March of 2000 to protest the current U.S. policy of sanctions toward Iraq and the U.N. role as promoter of conflicts it could have better resolved. His was a decision to not participate. It was a decision of conscience to not participate in what was unconscionable. Tonight and in these painful days, the situation in Iraq deteriorates. Later this month, the UK and the US will again try to change, through action of the UN Security Council, the UN sanctions policy to what Secretary of State Powell called smart sanctions. They will take advantage of the current international preoccupation with terrorism to advance their political agenda. Mr. von Sponeck's view on these proposed changes in the sanctions policy is extremely pertinent for us to hear tonight, and it is valuable. He has argued that these smart sanctions will not lead to improvement, but will, in his words, be a tightening of the rope around the neck of the average Iraqi citizen. Mr. von Sponeck believes that only a restoration of a national economy can end the 10-year decline that has inflicted enormous human costs and made Iraq's infant mortality rate near the highest in the world. The connections of U.S. government response to September 11th and the calculated catastrophe in Iraq are haunting. Tonight, as we seek to sharpen our vision of what needs to be done to achieve justice in Iraq without the bloodshed that occurred during and following the Gulf War and now in Afghanistan, we can celebrate that Mr. von Sponeck is a living reminder that individuals can make a powerful difference. Hans, in living out your visions for the dignity and well-being of every person, not just Americans, you have become a powerful example to us about the importance of conscience in times saturated with the unconscionable. We welcome you back to Seattle. We are thankful for your voice, for your quest for the truth, and for your presence here tonight with us. Welcome.
I hope you can hear me, but let me just start by saying I'm always very touched when I hear such warm words of welcome as I have heard them from Reverend Moe, from you, Reverend Boonstra, from my friend Bert Sachs, and from all the others who make it easy for me to be as transparent as I can possibly be. It also pains me a little bit that I'm always speaking about an ugly subject in a very beautiful environment, like a church like this one. But I guess that should not make me be less transparent and less critical of something which I have so painfully observed very directly in the 17 months I lived in Baghdad and interacted with the government of Iraq, with the U.S. State Department, with the British Foreign Office, and with the U.N. Security Council. This morning, I was asked to speak with a person in KIRO. This is the Dave Ross Show, I guess it's called. I don't like the word. But after that, someone called and said that he was sick and tired to hear a German appeaser, that what one should really do is bomb Iraq. Well, everyone is entitled to his or her view. I'm not an appeaser. I'm simply a person who has been in a certain reality. If you had been in that reality, I think you would have acted just as I did. So I'm not an appeaser. I'm also not a fanatic. And I want to assure you, if I'm critical of U.S. foreign policy, that doesn't make me anti-American at all. I'm pro-American in many ways. My wife, for one, is American. My son here in the audience is half American and half German. So I have studied in this country. I've been a UN official here in New York for 3 years. So I'm not anti-American at all. I'm also not an apologist for a brutal dictator. But when I speak about Saddam Hussein, I also want to be fair here somewhere. He is not a self-made man either. We have a whole portion to do with his ascendancy to brutality, and we should not totally forget that. Nor am I, and I want to say this particularly, if in this audience here tonight are also people from northern Iraq, maybe, from Kurdistan, Kurds. By not talking about the Kurdish issue doesn't make me insensitive to their very special circumstances. But this is only a fleeting moment that we have together, and I guess I must concentrate on Iraq and sanctions. Lastly, several times in Europe, there was a reference to the question of whether this man standing in front of an audience could possibly be paid by the Iraqis. I guarantee you, I'm not paid by the Iraqis. And maybe a little bit surprising, but bear with me. There's so much that is being said about terrorism, and I just feel compelled to begin with a minute of a general observation that relates to what I call the widening scissors. The widening scissors, I refer here to the widening gap between wealth and poverty. And I think that kind of a discussion is relevant to a discussion of terrorism and maybe even a discussion of terrorism and Iraq. But let me just say, in the 30 years, out of the 32 years that I was in the United Nations, I was dealing with poverty issues, with development issues, and therefore I'm very sensitive to that particular source of so much international conflict. And when you look at United Nations and other documentation and you see what really is a widening scissors, a widening gap between, for example, the top 20% and the bottom 20% in our world, I think when we try cool-headed, as we must be, to analyze the causes of terrorism, we have to talk about and think about that aspect also. Because I firmly believe that sick minds, and sick minds are the ones that are involved in terrorism, have a very fertile ground on which they can thrive in poverty. And if we overlook that, I think then we are not finding a path towards a solution in trying to get out of this most extreme form of dissatisfaction, which is terrorism. If you look, for example, I just want to give you a few to me significant pieces of evidence of this widening scissors before I move into the subject of tonight. But if you look, for example, at income, at national per capita income, if you compare the top, which is the U.S., with $29,000 per person per year, with the bottom, Sierra Leone, of $450. This is the enormous scissor, and it's widening. It's getting worse. If you look at longevity, if today you happen to be born in Japan, your chances that you will see your 80th birthday are absolutely the average. That is the average longevity, 80 years. But if you happen to be born in Malawi, in Central Africa, your chances to see your 30th birthday are statistically not good. The average lifespan in Malawi is 29 years. If you look at the global gross national product, an economic statistic, I think you see something you may not expect. 81% of global income is linked to 26 countries. And the other 160 countries that are members of the United Nations have the balance, 19%. So this is a fantastic disparity here between the haves and the have-nots. And what I always feel is a figure that I can almost not believe, but you can read it and you can follow it in the annual UN Human Development Reports, great documents to have, I encourage you to obtain, because they compare 170 plus, not all the countries, not all the 189 member countries of the UN, but most of them are compared in terms of economic indicators, in terms of social indicators, from crime rates in different countries to longevity and water supply and education. They're great. But if you look at the 1998 report, you see a figure which you probably think I'm inventing, but I'm not. It's simply passed on from the document. There were 357 billionaires in this world that owned 45% of global wealth. 357 individuals having 45% of global wealth, of the wealth of the earth, cash, liquid wealth in their pocket. Now, can there be a greater disparity than that if one compares this to the fact that there are 1.5 billion out of the 6 billion people that we are now on our globe who have less than $1 a day? 1.5 billion people having less than a dollar in their pocket per day, 357 individuals who have 45% of global wealth. Now, with this kind of enormous disparity, one should not really be surprised that there is a sweltering ocean of dissatisfaction that at times then can translate into various forms of animosity, of hostility towards those who are more fortunate but have so much excessive wealth to live on. And my last figure here, which is again to me always a powerful reminder that we have to become simply a little bit more humble in our life, and that is when I read and reread that 9 of our industrialized countries spend in 6 days 690 million dollars in dog and cat food. while 31% of children under 5 globally are malnourished. These are just a few examples that I think dramatically, to me at least, document the danger for the sort of things that we are seeing and have seen most recently on the 11th of September, because that is maybe an extreme manifestation, but there are many shades below that. And I hope that as our leaders begin to reflect on how and what they can do to get out of this sort of reality, that our response is more human security, less military security. Human security is what life should be about, and I hope our leaders understand that soon, better than they seem to at the moment. I want to start now my more specific observations on Iraq and sanctions by telling you that when it comes to this horrific, horrific savagery of the 11th of September, that any decent person anywhere, not just here in America, will feel angry, sad, and full of rejection for this atrocity. And in a way, we all, whether we are foreign or whether we are American, will feel American. The Europeans will feel with you as Americans. The Asians will feel with you as Americans. The Africans will feel with you as American. But I think we must not measure the tragedy of the 11th of September with a yardstick that is different from the yardstick with which we measure other tragedies around the world. And I would include here the tragedy of a criminally faulty foreign policy practiced by members of the UN Security Council, including your government. I'm sorry, I remind you here, anti-foreign policy doesn't make me anti-American, but I have to say that because it is a well-documented evidence of a wrong policy. So when it comes to Iraq and some of the statistics that I will give you in the course of this evening, then I must tell you, I feel angry, I feel sad, I feel I must reject wholeheartedly. And in the context of Iraq, I feel Arab and I feel Iraqi. There's no other way. I want to more specifically now try and explain to you what comprehensive economic sanctions have done to Iraq in the 11 years that such sanctions have existed. Practically today, Iraq is stripped of the sovereignty that normally an independent country enjoys. Iraq oil revenue, the lifeline for the people of Iraq, the oil revenue is being put into a French bank account, the Banque Nationale de Paris, and it is managed not by Iraq, but by the United Nations. That's number one. Number two, you need, everyone needs, a recurrent budget to finance civilian infrastructure costs. Your teachers must be paid. Your civil servants must be paid. The roads must be kept in good order. The hospitals must be kept. And if there is no money allocated for that, and I come back to this later, then you won't get very far. I heard with great interest that King County here, your county, in one of your counties, has a recurrent budget of $2.8 billion for 1.7 million people that live in King County, I'm told. Well, Iraq also needs some money, and Iraq, under sanctions, doesn't get one single dollar to maintain its civilian infrastructure. And the implications, of course, of that are clear. I will come back and explain this a little bit more. But the point, furthermore, is as far as comprehensive economic sanctions are concerned, no foreign investment. The oil industry cannot be modernized. There is no permission to open new oil wells. So Iraq can de facto only carry out simple repairs to the oil industry, no more than that. That's a band-aid approach, a very costly band-aid approach, but there's nothing that is permitted beyond that. And as a result of having really stymied an economy, you can imagine what that means to employment, what that means to heads of households earning a living. Not possible. All they have is to hold out their hand and get every month something, which I will explain when I briefly talk about the Oil for Food program. There is a massive social transformation occurring in Iraq today, which in fact means that the normal structure of the society, particularly the very strong and well-developed middle class, is dying out. Either they have emigrated, many are here, maybe even in this group here tonight, or they have become deprofessionalized, not able to work in the fields for which they were trained. And I want to remind you that Iraq had probably the most progressive economic and social system in the Middle East. It had a lot of money. It could do things, and they did things. In fact, they did them so well that in 1987, Iraq was awarded an international prize by UNESCO for having successfully brought down illiteracy to a level of 20%. 80% of the Iraqis in 1987 knew how to read and write, and the progress was so strong that a UN body could honor Iraq that it had made such progress. In 1997, 10 years later, the illiteracy rate had climbed back up to 45%. And with the main victim, women, Iraq was proud that it had a gender balance, that boys and girls in equal measure could go to school, could learn, and could progress in life. That today is quite a different story. So with this development, with this trend, it couldn't be hidden for 11 years. The knowledge, also thanks to groups that came to Baghdad, came to Iraq, saw the situation, reported back. And I want to single out and make special mention of the fact that when I served and lived in Baghdad for the year and a half, there was no other nationality that came more often to Iraq than American citizens. They came to see. Bert Sachs here in the front row is just one example of a person who had the courage to come, to understand. So the Americans were very sensitive to this situation. They wanted to interpret. And as a result of that, changes did occur, and the truth about the conditions in Iraq gradually surfaced more and more. So I want to quickly allay the impression that this is such an overwhelming, huge political problem that an individual citizen of a country cannot make a difference. Yes, we can all make a difference. And I think you should not feel shy, even with this overwhelming attempt to muzzle. And muzzling, there is plenty. I've experienced it firsthand. In fact, the spokesman of the State Department, when I began to speak out, because I felt I was not just a manager, I also was an interpreter, James Rubin said, "This man in Baghdad is employed to work, not to talk." Well, I think we should all not accept something like that. We must talk when we recognize something as faulty and as punitive as the comprehensive economic sanctions. The point I want to make is that under increasing pressure from some governments, for example, the Malaysian government, strong opponent to this kind of approach, but also from public groups like groups in this country, gradually the US and British foreign offices were cornered and had to come up with something new. What could that something new be? So here, there was reference made already in the introduction, the term smart sanction came forward. It's not a new term, but it came for the first time last June as far as Iraq is concerned. And as you can imagine, fertile minds quickly reacted saying, well, if they now, after 11 years, introduce smart sanctions, what were the sanctions during the previous 10 years or so? And you can give it any name, any. The fact was that they were very punitive and very wrong and punished the wrong party. So smart sanctions became the new slogan, and it looked good. And initially I thought, here is maybe a chance for finally for some more humane approach. How wrong was I? And I want to tell you why. Because the initial impression and what one still reads is that smart sanctions as proposed by the UK and supported by the US meant a freeing of all the restrictions on the import of civilian goods into Iraq. That sounded good and an acceptable and a good development. Not at all what I wanted to see, and that is a kickstart of the Iraqi economy, a return for the Iraqis to fend for themselves and to understand again what self-realization means. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights has that provision, a right for people to realize their full potential. Article 26 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Not possible under the present circumstance. So that would not have been possible even under the smart sanction proposals, unless you are really giving a chance for the Iraqi economy to function again. Under smart sanctions, that is not possible. Under smart sanctions, foreign investment is not possible. Under smart sanctions, the rehabilitation and modernization of the oil industry is not possible. So the basic parameters of the earlier comprehensive economic sanction regime didn't change. Until this moment, what I've said so far, I don't think the term malicious would be apt to describe the smart sanction proposal. The malicious part comes in when you read on, very rarely actually reported, and that is that Iraq's borders with Turkey in the north, with Syria, with Jordan, with Iran, and of course with Saudi Arabia and Kuwait would be hermetically closed. No more export of illegal oil outside. Well, if you hear this, you will say, great, this is fine. That's how it should be. Why should Saddam Hussein have the right to smuggle oil out? Well, you heard me earlier explain to you that that government doesn't get a penny for recurrent costs, for financing of the civilian infrastructure. And when you have that, this was a punitive, deliberate act, because it was repercussions of that were clear. If you have that situation, the government has to go that road towards adding revenue. And that revenue that they are getting, the highest figure that I have seen in the press comes to $3 billion per year. If you take the population of 23 million and you divide 3 billion, you're getting $130 per person per year. That's all there is for extra, for recurrent cost financing. And then you will say, yes, I did read about the palaces and the luxury goods and all the wasteful expenditure. It is correct, there is that. But that government, that brutal dictator and his government in Iraq, has no choice, also for political reasons, to use, I would say, not less than 90% of that $130 per person per year for this civilian infrastructure. The teachers, even though they are unbelievably badly paid, a primary school teacher gets $10,000 dinar or $5 a month. A professor in a university gets the equivalent of 19,000 dinar a month. That's just under $10. Now, the $130 per person must be used. Otherwise, this has severe implications. The nation will collapse completely. It's already near a collapse. But if you don't use this, then it will be even worse. So if you deprive Iraq from that income, then you are strangulating the Iraqis further, and the malicious part comes in when the UK explains, if the Iraqis continue to suffer after we have introduced smart sanctions, it's entirely the fault of the government. Now, the government can be blamed for many things, but increasingly the external side can be blamed for more. And when it comes then also to be so dishonest as pretending that you're trying to do something for the people while in fact you are making it worse for the people, then I think we have a very serious situation. I have to, of course, prevent such smart sanctions from being adopted. And for once, the Russians boycotted. They vetoed. There is not often a veto in the UN Security Council when it comes to Iraq, but on this one, the Russians stalled and it failed, and I hope this smart sanction proposal will never ever see the daylight again. But we will soon see what happens. I had 2 weeks ago with the Russian ambassador a meeting in New York. He said to me, it most likely we will go the easy way, and that is have a technical resolution that will simply extend the oil for food program for another 6 months. That means, ladies and gentlemen, business as usual. And if you accept the figure of 147 children per day dying, according to UNICEF, children under 5, multiply this by 6 months. And I kept saying as early as October 1999, when I was the Assistant Secretary General for Iraq in Baghdad, don't, government of Iraq, US, UK, Security Council, do not play the political battle on the back of the Iraqi people. So it's just easy to do this. You continue to play that political battle. And then if you come to June or to May, June, early July, then you look forward to your vacation. The Security Council then is empty in New York, more or less. People go away and forget that while you are somewhere enjoying your holiday in Iraq, the dying continues. All that, of course, played into my determination that I could not be associated any longer with a faulty policy, and by being associated with it, being also part of an act that is a violation, a clear violation of international law. Here now a word maybe on this oil for food program, because the oil for food program in a way is a smokescreen, a moral smokescreen, a fig leaf. It pretends to do something for the Iraqi people. And I would say, and I've said to the press, yes, it's an important program, the oil for food program. Without it, the people would be even worse off than they already are. But it is at the same time a completely inadequate program. Again, figures to me, maybe I hope to you also, will make the point I try to make. In 4.5 years of this oil for food program, I want to give you 4 figures. The first one is the entire oil revenue during these 4.5 years comes to $44 billion US dollars. For the humanitarian side, for the oil for food program, $26.3 billion became available. The balance was almost entirely available to what is called the United Nations Compensation Commission. That's an amount that is a commission in Geneva which gets this funding, 30 cents out of the U.S. earned oil dollar, and uses it to defray claims made by governments, by companies, and by individuals who feel that as a result of the invasion of Iraq into Kuwait, they were victimized. So that money is already taken out from meeting the needs of the Iraqi people. That means that's the difference between $44.4 billion and $26.3 billion. Now, that amount of $26.3 billion, if it had been entirely spent on humanitarian supplies, would have meant, quite a sobering figure, I think, $220 US dollars per person per year in humanitarian supplies. That's all. But what actually has arrived during that period from December 96 to July 2001 is half of it, $13.5 billion. And that translates into a per capita figure of And I call this, and you understand why, the $119.70 scandal. Because it is clearly a scandal. $119.70 is the entire amount that the Iraqi civilians got as benefits under the Oil for Food program per year, per person. And that is for what? That is not an amount in the pocket. This is for food, for medicines, for water, for sanitation, for agriculture, for electricity, and for education. That is nothing. So how I can each time I say what I say to you now, I get really upset. On the 5th of December last year, the U.S. ambassador to the Security Council goes before the council and says the U.S. government is satisfied that the Oil for Food program meets the need of the Iraqi people. You can read it. It's a public document. $119.70 is enough to meet the needs of the Iraqi people. I can't comprehend this. And what is often forgotten, and I'm sure in a church is appreciated, is that life, and we kept saying this again and again, my UN colleagues and I, life is not just about meeting physical needs. What about non-material needs? What about spiritual needs? That was spiritual needs, you better not mention it, because you would have been considered as even more blue-eyed and naive as I already was considered when I started to speak out and protest. Non-material needs about, I mentioned, self-realization, dignity, no chance. To work for your living, to have the feeling that you get a maximum opportunity to develop your human person as is enshrined in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, no chance, absolutely impossible. But it was, even if you just looked at it narrowly, about physical needs, what is $119.70? So, very upsetting, the inadequacy of this program, and also associated with this, dishonesty, straightforward dishonesty. The press reported Iraq, the oil ceiling has been lifted. Iraq can pump as much oil as it wants. And if it doesn't do that, you see, it is simply because they don't care about their own people. What was not said is, and you can check it if you don't believe, you can go to the internet, you can see the oil production figure for Iraq before and after that oil ceiling was lifted, and you will see no change, because it cannot change. The oil industry, according to the oil missions that we had every year, international missions, led by even a British, very interesting, a British came to Iraq, led the oil mission, and the conclusion year after year was the same. The Iraqi oil industry is in a dangerous state, and many of us, including myself, felt surprised that there hasn't been a major environmental catastrophe involving the Iraqi oil industry. And if you look at the oil flows, haven't changed. Exports between 2 and 2.2 million barrels a day. That is all. So oil ceiling removal was meaningless. They could say that because they knew that the Iraqi oil industry could not possibly produce more. So we are stuck with a very poorly implemented, because neither the government of Iraq initially nor today the British and American governments want to see that Oil for Food program running well. At this very moment, if you were to go and check, you would see that the figure of $4 billion in stalled items, in held back items by the Security Council, 98% of this account U.S., is a reality. Can you imagine that? $4 billion worth of medicines, of electricity spare parts, of oil spare parts, not reaching there, having been ordered, having been paid for very often, cannot come because of the fear or the alleged fear that this is because of dual use, because it could be used by the military. And sometimes it gets so ridiculous that one can laugh even when the circumstances are so serious. You probably have heard the most extreme case is the pencil story. Pencils were stopped from coming to Iraq because they contain graphite. And graphite you can use to make bombs. How many pencils do you need to make a bomb? So it becomes ridiculous, but it's not ridiculous. It is punitive. Everything, I could spend an hour to show you how punitive every aspect of this treatment of Iraq is, including holding back 30 cents out of each oil dollar earned. That money was needed badly, particularly in the initial phases of the Oil for Food program, when there was a cap. Indeed, there was a cap. The cap was $2.2 billion. Out of that, they took 30%. What the net was $1.3 billion for 6 months. That's nothing. That is a pitiful figure that is not even remotely able to meet the minimum physical needs of the country. So, punitive. Then comes, unfortunately, and maybe there are lawyers here in the audience, the international law, the Charter of the United Nations, the Conventions on the Right of the Child, the Hague Convention, are not tangible enough to protect innocent civilians under conditions as they exist in Iraq. And when you have, for example, Article 39 of the UN Charter, which is the basis for imposing sanctions, you read there, a country can be awarded sanctions, can be punished with sanctions, when there is an act of aggression or a threat to international security. That wording alone is intangible. What constitutes an act of aggression? What is a threat to international security? Different interpretations. But the power in the UN Security Council is the US. And it is, some people facetiously say, this is no longer the UN Security Council, it's the US Security Council. So this determined how one interpreted that international law. And it was the Canadian foreign minister, the former one, Lloyd Axworthy, who reminded the UN Security Council, saying the international sanctions should be implemented in accordance with international objectives and not in accordance with national interests of individual member countries. He was kind. He said countries. He should have said country, because it was the U.S. that was the determining voice. It's a fact. This is not a biased value judgment. It was a fact. And we know very well how many cowards there are in the UN Security Council. In December of 1998, when the new Iraq resolution was decided, China, Russia, and France, all three, didn't do what their integrity should have demanded them to do. Why not? China wanted to get into the World Trade Organization. Russia had Chechnya around their neck, and France was a member of NATO. So all of them, for extraneous reasons, as far as Iraq was concerned, decided to not do what their sense, what their conviction, their knowledge demanded, and that is to veto the proposal for a new UN resolution on Iraq, which in the Middle East, people started saying, do you know the saying which is, a mountain became pregnant and a little mouse was born? That little mouse was Resolution 1294-84 of December 98, which was not only a little mouse, but it was a dead mouse because it was never implemented. So here we have international law that is not tangible enough to protect a situation like in Iraq from misuse. And on top of it, and maybe that suffices then to show you how punitive this whole approach is, in the last 11 years, the procedures of the UN Security Council have changed. There is an ambassador who was the president of the Security Council who did an analysis, and he came out with the following findings. In the beginning, the meetings in the Security Council were considered public meetings, which means that every member government who wishes to sit in and listen and react could come and do so. The rules changed, and today, since quite a few years, the rules are informal. The meetings are considered informal meetings of the Security Council when it comes to Iraq. And that means only the 15 members of the Security Council can attend these meetings. Which also explains why when I came to New York to brief the UN Security Council, in the beginning I couldn't quite understand why each time Iraqi diplomats would mill with other diplomats outside the chambers of the Security Council. They would be anxious to pick up a word, to say hello to the few friends that they had. But when the actual meeting happened and the doors of the UN Security Council closed, Iraqi diplomats were not allowed to join. They were kept out. So they could not even participate to discuss or respond to issues involving their own country. I think that's maybe a dramatic example of the punitive nature with which Iraq has been treated. And then you get on top of it, you get the media. Now these days, this is why a little bit I started talking about terrorism, because there is that link between terrorism, anthrax, and Iraq. Read for facts. You won't find the facts. It's conjecture. And do we really have the courage to batter a people who have been punished for 11 years because the government of Saddam Hussein is in good shape? They are stronger and more stable than many other Middle Eastern governments. But the people are in bad shape. Now, can we continue to build a policy and maybe even now prepare for an attack against Iraq based on conjectures? I don't think we can. I think we must not. And it looks as if we want to really go ahead in finishing what some of our leaders consider unfinished business. I think that's very dangerous. And as the Secretary General of the Arab League said, you are setting the Middle East in flame if you start attacking Iraq. I thought this was a courageous statement that was made there. At the very end, let me just say, I would be wrong if I wouldn't offer at least a moment of thoughts on what can we do. And what we can do and should do is to reconvert the United Nations into that house of dialogue, not maintain this United Nations as a house of confrontation. The UN was created to solve conflicts, and now the UN exists and creates conflicts. That is an anomaly with such grave consequences that I am, even in these difficult days, when you in America and we in Europe and elsewhere try to find a way out of these very intractable problems that confront us, I think the word dialogue must become an acceptable word, and the Iraqis must be given an opportunity to meet with the Security Council. And if they talk rubbish, if they are dishonest, if we don't have a hidden agenda, we have enough knowledge to know whether they are honest or not honest with us, and give them a chance to explain themselves. On the 26th of this year, the Secretary General had his first meeting with Minister Al-Sahaf, the foreign minister of Iraq, and it was a promising step forward. But he was muzzled. He was told by the British and American governments, you stop meeting with the Iraqis until we have developed another Iraq policy. Well, where is the other Iraq policy? This was in June. We are now in November. So dialogue meeting at that level is, to me, very important. As is important that the Arabs are meeting among themselves. King Abdullah of Jordan and the Secretary General of the Arab League, Dr. Amr Moussa, have been appointed to be negotiators, reconciliators, if you want, between Iraq, Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia. Give them a chance, and let us as Westerners not always have this horrible tendency of looking over other people's shoulders and try to make sure that what they are writing down and what they are discussing is what we want them to do. If we do that, we are inviting more of what we are seeing these days and shouldn't be at all surprised. So let the Arabs talk among themselves. 3 or 4 years ago, one could have said, yes, it's possible to look at Palestine and look at Iraq separately. No more possible. Today, these two things are inextricably linked, and the Middle East peace process must involve both, but as a forerunner to hopefully an eventual dialogue with Israel also. Israel cannot be ignored, mustn't be ignored. But at this point, there must be an opportunity for the Arab governments to meet among themselves. And lastly, there has to be also an intra-Iraq dialogue between the Kurds in the north and those who live south of the line of control and the Baghdad authorities. The Shias and others, minorities, must talk, and the Shias, sorry, they are not a minority, in fact, they are the majority, but everyone who has something to do in this ethnic picture in Iraq must be given an opportunity to discuss. And when you have these three levels of dialogue, maybe there is a chance. The big assumption here is that there is no hidden agenda, that we don't continue to do, to say one thing, but in fact do what Henry Kissinger said with such brutal frankness a few years ago when he said, oil is much too important a commodity to be left in the hands of the Arabs. With that attitude, God help us. That's all I can say. But let me, at the very end, just a little story, which I told to Bert this afternoon, which I think makes a good point. And the point is obvious. But it's something which I always remember when there's a moment when you think, what can we as individuals really do to make a difference? And then I remember that little story of the old man who walks along the beach. I was the UN representative in India. It reminds me of an Indian beach where you see a lot of starfish lying in the sun. And the sun is brutal. The sun kills the starfish unless the starfish has a chance to find water. So he walks along the beach and he sees this little girl and she picks up a starfish and throws it into the waves. And he goes to her and he says, well, what are you doing? She says, I'm just throwing this back in the water. The brutal sun will kill the starfish. He said, but there are thousands of starfish here on the beach. This is not going to be very helpful. She takes another starfish and she looks at the old man and she throws it into the water and she says, it made a difference to this one. Thank you very much.